It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we learn about a program addressing the sexual side effects of cancer treatment on women's health. A recent review of the research suggests over 60% of women with cancer experience sexual dysfunction, but sexual health may be overlooked or deprioritized in fighting the disease. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, any point here, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Janelle Sobecki is Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program and Assistant Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Sobecki, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So why should women be concerned about their sexual health during and after cancer treatment?
Absolutely. Well, you know, for everyone, patients and, you know, the general population, both, sexual health is important to everyone, right? Sexual health may look different for every individual, but it's something that affects nearly everyone and is such an important part of a woman's quality of life. You know, we also know that cancer treatment, like you mentioned, can affect, you know, anywhere up to, you know, we think 75%, you know, in the work I do, even 100% of women who have had cancer and have gone through cancer treatment. So this is a really, really common side effect that is incredibly important to not only a woman's quality of life, but, you know, her relationship if she's in one, as well as her partner's quality of life and her partner's sexual health and life as well.
How do chemotherapy and radiation, you know, which are common cancer-fighting treatments, how might they affect sexual health?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we know for women, about two-thirds of cancers directly affect a woman's sexual organ. So these are cancers of the breast, cancers of the reproductive system, gynecologic cancers, you know, that includes cancers of the vulva, vagina, uterus, cervix, ovary. And so, you know, about two-thirds of women with cancer, their cancer and their cancer treatment directly affects the sexual organ. You know, for the remainder of women with cancer, we also know that women with cancers that do not affect a sexual organ also have sexual health concerns. That can be women with, you know, colorectal or bladder cancers. I call those sexual organ adjacent. So treatments to those areas can have an impact to the sexual organs themselves. We also know women with other cancers like head and neck cancers, lung cancers, also experience sexual problems as a result of their treatment. Pretty much every cancer treatment can affect sexual health in one way or another. You know, surgery is a really obvious area where, if, you know, a woman has surgery to a sexual organ, that's obviously going to have side effects. Radiation therapy can certainly cause side effects, you know, to the surrounding skin, the structures. And chemotherapy, you know, I have patients who are in chemotherapy who describe a skin sensitivity, fatigue, you know, things that we don't directly think will impact sexual health, but absolutely do.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here for just a moment. Dr. Janelle Sobecki, talking about sexual health in women during and after cancer treatment. She's medical director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program at UW Health. You can join in the conversation about sexual side effects of cancer, 800-642-1234. Dr. Sobecki, one other aspect here, you know, in addition to chemotherapy and radiation, are hormonal medications that are prescribed to cancer patients. What are those types of side effects in relation to sexual health?
Absolutely. So hormonal therapies typically cause a loss of estrogen. And what that loss of estrogen does for women is it can result in vaginal dryness, sometimes vaginal atrophy, which is where the tissues of the vagina change in a way that makes sexual function more painful, makes the intercourse more painful. You know, hormonal therapies can also cause other side effects, especially for women who are premenopausal. So that can include hot flashes, trouble with sleep. And all of these things together can create side effects that prohibit women from being able to enjoy a good sexual life.
How should patients, though, balance that cancer treatment, you know, versus the risk of sexual health problems down the line? I mean, that's a really tricky conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that's a growing area that we are exploring to try to figure out how best to do that. You know, I think in cancer treatment and surgery, we talk so much with patients about risks, right? Risks of surgery, risks of treatment, risks of chemo. And, you know, I consider sexual health and risks to sexual health and sexual problems a part of that conversation. You know, we know cancer treatments are not side effect free. In fact, the opposite, they cause quite a few side effects. But sexual health is an important one that should be part of the discussion along with all of the other side effects that we commonly speak with patients about.
We have gynecologic oncologist Janelle Sadecki raising awareness about sexual health in women cancer survivors. You can voice your questions, share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers, they find sexual side effects of cancer treatment are discussed much less frequently with female patients than with male patients, even when the treatment directly affects sex organs. Call in with questions, your experiences fighting cancer, and sexual issues you've encountered. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Janelle Sobecki, who is Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Sobecki, I want to just touch down on the oncology community here for a moment because, you know, talking about sexual health has not been something that has been seems like a pressing concern. It's kind of been backburnered in the past. What is happening now among oncologists?
Yeah, I think, you know, the past, I would say 5 to 10 years has really shown growth in the awareness of this issue and awareness of sexual health as an important quality of life component to female cancer care. You know, there are very talented people across the country in various centers who are really advocating for this area, generating good research evidence for how best to care for this important issue. And I think, you know, it's gained a lot of traction. It certainly is not where we or our patients wish it was. But I think there are a lot of talented people really trying to improve this important area for women.
Let's bring on a call now. Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. What about the mental health aspects of a woman's sexual health post-cancer treatment, perhaps losing a breast to a mastectomy? Does this affect her mental image of who she is as a woman? So what are we doing about the mental health corner? Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin, for bringing this up. You know, I think this area is incredibly important. You know, we know sexual health is not just our bodies, right? It's bio, it's psycho, it's social, you know, and those emotional and, you know, psychological or relational components to sexual health are incredibly important. It is also very common for us to see women who have undergone treatments have issues related to their body image and self-image as a, you know, a sexual person. We see this most commonly with women with breast cancer who may have, you know, removal of the breasts or surgery to the breasts. And if that breast, you know, if their breasts were a sexual organ, they now, you know, don't have one, or they have a breast that is reconstructed. And I hear from patients that, you know, the reconstructed breast looks good under a top, but doesn't function the same. And her partner, you know, may have issues related to needing to avoid that breast, you know, during sexual activity because it brings up, you know, negative feelings regarding cancer treatment. We work closely with some of our behavioral therapists at UW and, you know, across the state so that, you know, issues that are pertaining to mental health and how that affects, you know, sexual health for, you know, women and their partners can be addressed alongside the other work that we do, you know, with some of the physical changes.
You also had surveyed women with colorectal cancer reporting lack of confidence or fear of incontinence during sex. What is your advice to women, cancer survivors, who feel unconfident in their body after treatment?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first is kind of a restructuring of, you know, how they feel and what they want their sexual life to look like. You know, when they're partnered, we recommend, you know, there are different activities that, you know, partners and patients can go through where they talk about areas that they do and don't want touched in a sexual encounter so that in the middle of a sexual encounter, there isn't, you know, an uncomfortable, you know, viewing or touching of an affected body part, which can be really helpful. You know, we also refer patients, you know, who need more talk therapy about that. And I think communication is key in recognizing that, you know, these women are not alone. You know, I do this work every day. And, you know, this is a community of people who we know this is so common and adjustments have to be made. But, it oftentimes it's deeper than that, right? The body and body image brings up a lot of negative feelings about cancer and fear of what the future may look like. And so, you know, like many things, it's complicated, but there's a lot of resources and a lot of ways that that can be overcome.
Your program refers some patients for pelvic floor physical therapy. What does that entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that the pelvic floor, which is the, you know, sort of bowl of muscles in the pelvis, is really integral to many functions, but sexual function in particular. And so pelvic floor physical therapy can be incredibly helpful in helping women who have pain with intercourse, who have, you know, kind of in the tightness of that pelvic floor or trigger point pain of the pelvic floor. And it really works on helping that pelvic floor function normally, whether that's, you know, contracting better, relaxing better, and that can include external and internal, you know, manual manipulation. It's a very talented group of people and a really important piece of helping women with certain sexual problems.
How successful is it? How effective?
Yeah, so, you know, we have limited data, but the data that we have from patients in our own clinic who we have sent, you know, nearly all of them report that that intervention is helpful. You know, so we certainly have more to learn about how effective, but, you know, for our patients who have seen us in Wish Clinic and been referred, they do report that that was helpful.
Turning to sex therapy, in your survey of patients who participated in the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program, few were referred to sex therapy. Why is that?
Yeah, referral to sex therapy and any of the other referrals that we do is really individualized based on, you know, the woman, if she has a partner, and the goals. And so, you know, any woman who is struggling with, you know, body image, mental health, a woman and a partner who are struggling about communication about sexual health or the changes that have happened after cancer, those are patients that we often refer. You know, so we take an integrative approach and, you know, refer patients to sex therapy when it's appropriate for the problem that they come to us with. And if we feel like that's a helpful component.
What about reproductive health and the potential after that cancer not being able to have a baby?
Yeah, absolutely. So that in particular is not my area of expertise, though many women where fertility is an issue. And so, you know, the most important part there is knowing a woman's goals, you know, discussing fertility sparing options if they are possible, depending on the type of cancer, and, you know, looping in our really talented partners at the Generations Fertility Center, you know, and taking a really multidisciplinary approach to, you know, maintaining fertility if it's possible, and having really thoughtful conversations with women about what those side effects might look like.
I wonder, Dr. Sebeki, like, this can be a sensitive subject for patients. And how do you recommend having the talk with your oncologist and not make it feel like you're downgrading the focus of the mission, which is to, you know, eradicate the cancer, and that would be the pure focus. How do you make this type of talk, you know, elevated and not make it feel like it's not important to what our mission is here, which is to cure this cancer?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, side effects are an integral component of every step of cancer care. So that, you know, side effects are discussed, they're monitored. We, you know, support women with therapies for side effects, and sexual side effects shouldn't be any different. You know, we know from, you know, providers and patients, it's uncomfortable on both sides. I think my best advice, and hopefully this program has helped, is that these issues are so common. Nearly every woman with a cancer has had some impact to their sexual life. And so arming yourself with that confidence to say this is really important and it's happening to nearly everybody. You know, the other really important piece of knowledge is that nearly every cancer organization recognizes sexual health as an important component of cancer care. So there is a lot out there about this issue, but there's a disconnect in the office sometimes. And with anything else, I think timing is everything, right? So if you're someone who wants to discuss this, you know, use the opportunity at the beginning of the visit to say, you know, whether that's an intake form or when you're getting your vitals checked, you know, say, I have some concerns related to my sexual health that I'd really like to talk about today. That sets the visit up for time to address that well, you know, rather than, you know, kind of everything's wrapping up and we call it the doorknob question, you know, we're ready to go and, oh, wait a second, I have this question. you know, and that's hard, right? That's hard for patients getting to their next thing. It's hard for the, you know, physician or medical provider. So I think timing and recognition that, you know, this side effect is just as important as surgical side effects and chemo side effects and radiation side effects, which we talk about and treat every day in cancer care. So there's no reason we can't do the same for sexual health.
Dr. Janelle Sobecki, Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program with us, an Assistant Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Still time to talk about sexual side effects and cancer, 800-642-1234. Dr. Sobecki, what sexual side effects of cancer are permanent for women?
I'd like to think none in the work that I do, but we know that unfortunately is not the case. You know, I think one of the biggest things we see is women who have either had their ovaries taken out or have had medications that cause a loss of estrogen, you know, that does permanently change the tissues of the vagina. And so we know those tissues will never be what they were when estrogen was present. And that can cause, you know, vaginal dryness, which can cause pain with intercourse. And those changes oftentimes are permanent. You know, certainly surgery, removal of sexual organs or, you know, a change to the sexual organs from, you know, radiation treatment, those things are permanent changes. Not to say that we don't have interventions to improve things, but many cancer treatments do cause permanent changes to somebody's body and sexual organs.
What needs to be further studied and examined in the sexual health of cancer patients?
I'm going to say everything. there have been so many talented people working on this. I think that, you know, we've highlighted one area, which is communication, you know, which seems like it should be simpler, right? We have done work and research that shows that women want their cancer team to bring this up. So we hear that certainly a lot. And, you know, we hear from providers, it's hard to talk about. And I think medical teams want to help, right? That's inherent in medicine and cancer care. But I don't know that everybody feels equipped to ask, because if a patient brings up an issue, they may not be sure what to do next and how to help them best. And so I think communication and, you know, recognition of resources is really an incredibly important step, because nobody knows there's a problem if nobody's talking about it. And I think that's an area that could easily improve.
Dr. Sobecki, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Janelle Sobecki is medical director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program and an assistant professor of gynecologic oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We have a link to the survey published in the journal Supportive Care in Cancer. You can find that link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up, we investigate the growing backlog in Wisconsin's immigration courts, the lack of immigration attorneys, and the effect this is having on our immigration system. But first, there is a presidential primary coming up in Wisconsin. But voters in the perennial swing state are finding that some of the political fervor they're used to is missing. That's because President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump secured their respective Democratic and Republican nominations for president weeks ago. As Sean Johnson reports, their November rematch has some voters uneasy.
On a recent Saturday, the inside of the Waukesha Expo Center is filled with vendors selling a little bit of everything at an event called Rummage-O-Rama. There are tables full of vintage clothes, furniture, and toys. Another sells steel oil cans, still full. For shoppers and vendors, this is fun. They're a little less excited to talk about politics. When asked about the upcoming April primary, some, like Gary Wolenzine of Waukesha, say they don't like either of the candidates. Wolenzine thinks Biden has spent too much money. He calls Trump a schoolyard bully. Wolenzine would typically vote Republican. This year, he may not vote at all.
That may be the first time I have not voted for a president in an election because they're both incompetent and not presidential material.
Rachel Cartwright of Oak Creek says she's also not sure either candidate is up to the job. For the first time in her life, she says she's afraid to even talk about who she supports in politics.
You know, we can't just calmly speak on who we believe in. That I think, has made this whole process a lot more difficult than it used to be.
A Waukesha voter named Kathy, who would only give her first name, says her sons no longer talk because of politics. There won't be third-party candidates on the ballot in April, but she'll consider them in November.
There has to be somebody else out there. I'm the eternal optimist, and I gotta believe there's somebody. I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat, but there's gotta be somebody else out there.
Not everyone is this unhappy with the current state of politics, but this snapshot of voters in swing state Wisconsin is more than just anecdotal. Trump and Biden both have negative approval ratings here. And in the last few Marquette University Law School surveys, pollster Charles Franklin says between 17 and 20% of voters had negative views of both candidates.
That's more an expression of dissatisfaction today than it is a prediction of whether they will actually vote or not in November. But it certainly shows that for this group of 17 to 20% of the electorate, they are seriously considering sitting it out or voting for someone other than Biden or Trump.
On the April ballot, voters' options are limited. Six Republicans appear alongside Trump, but they've long since dropped out of the race. For Democrats, there's a push to get progressives to vote uninstructed, a stand activists say would send a message that Biden's position on the war in Gaza is unacceptable. For people who work in politics, like Democratic operative Joe Zepecki, the state of the race has their attention.
It's concerning, full stop. The electorate is unruly and people are frustrated.
Zepecki says the answer for Democrats is to highlight Biden's record and remind voters of Trump, including his role in trying to overturn the last election.
I believe that the vast majority of the American public has not yet tuned into this election, and that a couple billion dollars in advertising and the stakes of this election are going to bring it home.
Not everyone needs that convincing. Back at the Waukesha rummage sale, Keith Best with the County Republican Party says Trump voters are excited about this year.
We're at different events like this. We see that so many people come up to us and they want to talk politics because they don't have anybody that they can talk with at home. Sometimes it's just they want to vent.
And Biden voter Linda Jordan of Milwaukee says there's a lot to like about the president. She thinks other Democrats will come around.
I think when it comes down to it, everyone's, they'll come out. Those that are interested in their country, that are interested in politics, in our democracy, I believe they'll, you know, they may feel that way, but in practice or whatever, I believe that they will come out.
It's one thing to complain about the candidates in April, Jordan says. In November, she thinks people will see the election in a different light. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning. And a new report from WPR News follows immigrants in Wisconsin as they try to navigate their way through our immigration courts. Almost 25,000 in our state are currently waiting for a hearing and are facing the possibility of deportation. When they finally do get their day in court, about 3 out of 4 will do so without any attorney. When you have the time, check out the full WPR news story on our website, and you can find it linked at WPR.org/mornings. That's WPR.org/mornings. And you're welcome to this conversation. We welcome your questions and comments at any time as we investigate our immigration system and the backlog we find here in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And Aaron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Lee.
So 5 years ago, immigrants had legal representation in an estimated 65% of cases nationally. That number is down to 30% today, according to one measure. And in Wisconsin, that rate is even lower still. Aaron, why are rates of representation so low here in Wisconsin?
You know, they're low across the nation because there is no federal money, generally no federal money to provide representation for people who are in deportation proceedings. And that's in Wisconsin as well. And so I find that we have what I term as like an immigration representation desert in Wisconsin, because there are very few attorneys who can represent people either lo bono or pro bono without charge. And so people often have to face the deportation system on their own.
Aaron, why would you want an attorney with you present for your immigration hearing?
It's a really good question, but we do presentations with children sometimes about what immigration court looks like. And we describe it in terms of like a soccer game. So the judge is the ref, the ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement attorney, is the other team. And then the respondent is the person who is facing deportation. It's basically, we would explain it as a professional team versus someone with no experience. So, a minor league team playing against a professional team. And that's not fair, especially when the consequences are not winning or losing a game, but winning or losing the chance to remain in the country the only country you've ever known, or where your family lives, your job is, or the consequence of never being able to return to the United States ever again.
So that's why you'd need an attorney. Why are there so few immigration attorneys in Wisconsin as you see it, Aaron?
There are few immigration attorneys in Wisconsin for a number of reasons. I think the main reason is there's just not enough funding to provide for pro bono, lo bono services in Wisconsin. Some states do fund attorneys to represent people who are in deportation proceedings. We don't have any of that right now. A few years ago, we did, but that money is no longer available. But the other situation is that being an immigration attorney is not an easy job. And I look at the brilliant, passionate pro bono attorneys that we do have here in Wisconsin right now, and I worry that they will burn out. It's a really tough job.
Aaron Barbato, our guest, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And Aaron, as I understand it, you're also on the board of the Community Immigration Law Center. What work do you do they do, and you do, with immigrants in Wisconsin?
No, the Community Immigration Law Center has three attorneys there that are immigration attorneys, and they represent people who are facing deportation. They also provide, the board and other volunteer attorneys provide free legal consultations every second and fourth Friday of every month, just so people can have access to some trusted information before they go and hire an attorney or know whether they should hire an attorney. The Community Immigration Law Center has done something incredibly powerful in the past year, where they started providing pro se clinics to people who are seeking asylum in the U.S. So it's not full representation, but it allows people to have enough information so that they know how to hopefully navigate the system on their own, which is not the goal, but it's better than having them not know anything about the system. So they are providing a huge service to the community and trying to provide some access to justice to the people who are seeking refuge in our country.
Do you have an idea of how many people the Community Immigration Law Center was able to help last year in Wisconsin?
The numbers are, they're high. I don't have the exact numbers, but I know that there is a long waiting list to come to even the pro se clinics. So there's not enough resources to fulfill the need even for pro se information, where someone would be representing themselves on their own. So they are constantly they can't fulfill the needs of the community, even though they do everything possible to fulfill those needs.
Aaron, what are some of the common barriers for people seeking asylum here who are already living here and are applying without legal representation?
So the immigration system in and of itself is incredibly complicated. We don't have an immigration court here in Wisconsin. We have an immigration court in Chicago. So part of it is just being able to know where you're supposed to go for your first hearing. One major issue is being able to afford an attorney. So people who have recently arrived in the U.S. generally aren't going to have thousands of dollars to hire a private bar attorney to represent them. And so when they look for an attorney on a pro bono realm, they're looking at about potentially five or six attorneys in the entire state that could potentially represent them. And that simply is not enough. So the bar for them to receive representation is super high. And it's really almost impossible for people to find legal representation in Wisconsin for representation in deportation proceedings.
Let's go to your calls and comments now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff in Delafield, you're on the air with Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to play devil's advocate here. And my question is, why is it the taxpayer's responsibility to make the case for why these people should be here? Presumably, there's laws. There's the government that, through ICE or whatever, that's enforcing the laws that are there that say who should be here, who's able to be here, who isn't, based on asylum rules. So, with all the needs for money today, low graduation rates, problems with Milwaukee Public School, all the problems we face, why is it our responsibility as taxpayers to make the case for who should be here and who shouldn't? With the laws we have in place now that I would think are fairly clear to say who should be here and who shouldn't. Why should we be paying for attorneys to make that case for people that want to be here for whatever reason?
Jeff, thank you for the question. Aaron?
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for the question. I think, as someone who's been working in the system for a very long time, I do see the injustice involved. And in 1980, when we codified our asylum laws, we made a promise to the world to protect people who are being persecuted in their home countries. And our country, per our constitution, provides representation for people who are charged with crimes. But that doesn't go, that doesn't work with the immigration system, even though people are facing really harsh consequences for it. So when you look at whether someone is going to be deported, potentially deported separated from their family for the rest of their life, or return to a country where they could be persecuted or tortured. I think as a country, we want to make sure that that's a level playing field. And in order to have a level playing field, and so that we don't deport someone back to a country where they will be persecuted and or face harsh consequences otherwise, I think as a community and as a country, we would want to make sure that that's a fair system. And as it stands now, without legal representation for people facing deportation, it's not fair, in my opinion. So I would hope we could level that playing field to ensure we are doing what's right for humankind.
Taking a look at the backlog in our immigration system and what that means here in Wisconsin, and it's from a report from WPR News last week, which I encourage you to read when you have the time at WPR.org/mornings. Our guest is Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School and on the board of the Community Immigration Law Center, which is on the front lines here of working with our immigrants through the immigration system, those who are facing deportation, those who are seeking asylum. So if you have a question or comment about what we are facing and what we can do to fix our immigration system, I invite you to join us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the backlog in our immigration courts and the real shortage of immigration attorneys in Wisconsin. And please make sure you check out the full report from WPR News and Sarah Lear at WPR.org/mornings. Our guest, Aaron Barbato, is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and your questions and comments are welcome here. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And I found this interesting, Aaron. A recent Gallup survey found 28% of Americans see immigration as the biggest problem facing our United States. I'm curious, is public opinion of immigration contributing to some of the shortages we're seeing and some of the backlogs we're finding?
You know, I'm not sure if they are contributing to the backlogs. I think part of the issue is just a broken immigration system that has not been really updated to modern times for a long time. I mean, I file most of some of them electronically. A lot of it is done by paper. A lot of it is still sent to clients and to us by snail mail. So it's just somewhat of an archaic system that hasn't met up with modern times. But the laws haven't changed and Congress hasn't acted to modernize our immigration system that really will reflect what the people want.
So in other words, then, do you see a failed immigration system as contributing to the public opinion about immigration?
I think so. I mean, I think that what people see and some of the visions and the words used in the media are really used in a hyperbole, in a way that is creating a crisis that maybe isn't a crisis, but the term crisis is continued to be used all of the time. When I think if we took a step back and really looked at ways we could modernize and humanize our immigration system, there would be less concern and more agreement on how we can use immigration to better our country and to serve the world in general.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-642-1234. Karen, good morning. You're on the air with Aaron Barbato from the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School.
Good morning. I have a question. I would like to have the guests talk a little bit about what kinds of folks come to the process of immigration. We hear a lot about the criminal illegals that come in, you know, that are doing a lot of harm and stuff. But how do the people that get to a point of being, you know, being able to be represented in court, how do they get vetted so that, you know, like we're helping people that truly deserve to be helped versus like criminals coming in that they shouldn't be here anyways?
Karen, thank you so much for the question. And Aaron, what kinds of people come to the point of going into this immigration system?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Karen. And I think, you know, there's somewhat some fear-mongering going on out there about the people that are seeking refuge or immigrating to the U.S. When most of the people that we are working with in Wisconsin, and particularly at the Community Immigration Law Center, are people that are coming to the U.S. to seek asylum. So they fear persecution in their home country. Before they can enter the United States, they go through a vetting process and they have an interview with Customs and Border Protection to ensure that they don't have a criminal record or something that would make them danger to society. And I think that's really misunderstood. The border is patrolled, and certainly there are people that cross irregularly into the United States, but those that are processed and allowed to live within the community during the pendency of their immigration court hearing have been vetted, and they're not people that have been found to be a danger to society. And so, and if someone has an issue with law enforcement within the U.S., they are, ICE is notified, but that is rare.
Erin Barbato, we have a backlog in our immigration courts. We have a lack of immigration attorneys to help with people who are facing deportation and possible persecution in their home countries. With about a minute and a half left here, what needs to happen to fix this part of our immigration system? What would you see as a solution?
I mean, there has to be comprehensive immigration reform. I think I do go to court in Chicago. I see the judges there working hard to provide fair court hearings for individuals arriving. But the problem is just, it's incredibly widespread, and we continue to politicize a humanitarian issue. I think in the research and the work that I do, I have found that there is potential to decrease the need for people crossing the southern border. As it stands now, the law, most people who want to seek asylum in the U.S. have to do it at the southern border. There isn't another choice. And I think that's misunderstood within in the United States. But Biden has started some additional, they're called safe mobility offices, where people can apply for refugee or protection outside of the country, in Colombia, Costa Rica, and a few other countries. I think that might be a way that we can modernize our system and decrease the harm that is done within the United States and to the people that are seeking refuge here.
Erin, thanks as always for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Erin Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Law School, University of Wisconsin Law School, pardon me, as well as on the board of the Community Immigration Law Center, which is part of the story from WPR News, is Sarah Lear. And I would, again, highly encourage you to check out that in-depth reporting on our immigration courts backlog and the lack of immigration attorneys in Wisconsin, WPR.org/mornings. That's WPR.org/mornings. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison is celebrating their 40th anniversary. As part of that celebration, Ezra Klein will be coming to Madison to talk about our nation's seemingly vast political divide and what needs to be done to overcome it. Ezra Klein writes for the New York Times opinion section. He hosts the Ezra Klein Show podcast and is author of Why We're So Polarized. Ezra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're visiting Wisconsin in a few weeks here for a talk about the rise in polarization. What would you say is behind this polarizing of us?
Oh, my goodness. Wrote a whole book on it. So, you know, there are different things at different times. My book came out in 2020. And when I wrote it, I was tracking a way that the parties had changed over the course of much of the 20th century. And there's a kind of quick and big historical story you can tell about that. You know, we really had a four-party system early in the 20th century where you had very conservative Southern Dixiecrats and more liberal Democrats. You had more liberal Republicans, more conservative Republicans. And it's really the Civil Rights Act and the sort of racial polarization and realignment that created the two-party system we know now. And so I got a whole story you could tell about polarization built around that. I would say something has changed, though, in the past 4 years, where the locus of polarization, I think, has become much more around the system itself. When you think about polarization, you always want to ask the question, what are we actually divided over? And increasingly, we're divided over this question of, you know, these questions that right-wing populism bring into the story, which is, you know, are institutions fundamentally corrupt? Is the political system fundamentally corrupt? Are elections fundamentally stolen? You now have these much more strange bedfellow coalitions where Mitt Romney seems in many ways more like a Democrat, even though he's a Republican nominee as recently as 2012. But the Republicans and this sort of whole anti-MAGA coalition have become much further from, and the whole MAGA coalition become much further from each other. So polarization, big topic and something to keep an eye on is that it's always changing. The locus of division is always changing.
Yeah, and I appreciate that update, Ezra, is a look at whether or not the systems even work, the institutions still operate on behalf of the people. But how do you begin to bridge, what does a bridge across that political divide even look like when folks are doubting the systems, institutions themselves?
It is not obvious to me right now that there is a bridge across the political divide. People don't like to hear that.
Huh.
But, you know, I've been in politics for a long time now, 20 years. And for most of my time in politics, you had a lot of these efforts aimed at creating, you know, bipartisan civil dialogue. And one of the things that I was talking about with a friend the other day is that those have kind of all collapsed, these things like no labels and other things like that. Because, you know, when we were discussing and debating and disagreeing over policy, right, if you think about the period where the big division in the country had to do with whether we would pass Obamacare or the Paul Ryan budget, even if that was a highly polarized time, you can imagine ways to get around it because policy is fundamentally positive sum. I can come up with a healthcare system or a tax system or a social security system that would, from both conservative and liberal perspectives, make a lot of people better off. Now, we might not end up there because there are elections and one side and the sides don't want to agree in many cases because the minority party does not want to give the majority party a win. But when you are actually asking about policy, there's a lot you can do. When you're asking about power, there's a lot less you can do. And particularly when you get into these questions when we, you know, have deep divisions over, you know, whether or not the 2020 election was even fair, right? And obviously, I think it was. But the nature of the division, it just came out yesterday, the Republican National Committee has been asking job applicants if they believe the 2020 election was stolen or not. If the nature of the polarization becomes that fundamental, then what you really have is competition. You're not going to bridge a divide. One side is going to lose. One side is going to win. They might trade power back and forth. But it's much more dangerous and unstable system because you can't really compromise over the question of was the 2020 election stolen. That isn't a zone for constructive bargaining.
Ezra Klein, our guest, New York Times columnist, author, podcast host, and will be visiting Wisconsin coming up early next month. And I'm curious from your perspective, Ezra, the role you see identity playing in our politics.
I think in some ways, politics is always about identity. And we don't always like to admit that. But one of the points I make in the book is that in many ways, the rise of what we call identity politics actually reflects identity becoming weaker in this country, not stronger, or at least identity becoming more pluralistic. So politics doesn't seem like it is about identity when one identity is really able to dominate. So for a very long time, there was a very normative American identity, white, male, Christian, and power was held by members of that identity class. And they were able to hold the system together such that everything else looked non-normative. Everything else looked marginal. Everything else looked like something surprising, right? I mean, it's fairly recent that we have significant female representation actually in the elected political system, right? I mean, it's only in the early 20th century that you even get the women having the right to vote. It's only in the 60s you really get the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. So what you have now, because of how America's changed demographically, is a system where you don't have one identity with a hammerlock on power. You have more identities, people from more perspectives contesting political power and, you know, arguing that they deserve a piece in it. And that makes for a much more conflictual system with many more identities, you know, competing with each other. But at the same time, you actually have a system where many more kinds of voices can be heard. So this is, I think, a bit of a paradox of the time, that at the same time that identity becomes most visible, it becomes weakest. There is no one dominant class now in the way there has been at other times, in fact, at most times in American history. But that the very end of that has created a kind of political instability that people feel as, that people experience as division.
Ezra Klein, what about the way we divide ourselves? I think about our congressional districts here, our legislative maps in Wisconsin, which has recently been redrawn with a bipartisan agreement as a result of a state Supreme Court pending decision. And we've got the WPR has this great podcast about the gerrymandering of Wisconsin over a decade ago now called Mapped Out, worth checking out. But the way we organize ourselves, does that play a role in the way we are polarized today as you see it?
It very much does. I mean, you know, there's the polarization of the public, right, what the public believes, and there's a polarization of the political system. And oftentimes the political system is a lot more polarized than actual people. You know, one of the ways I have to talk about this is that at the end of the day, politics has as a way of collapsing what are very complicated political opinions down into binary political opinions, right? You might have all these views about the world. At the end of the day, you have to vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. You have to vote for, you know, this Senate candidate or that Senate candidate. That gets even worse when the Senate, when this House candidate or that House candidate can, instead of facing a sort of normal sample of voters, right, a sample of voters chosen and constructed in some fair way, when they're actually choosing their own voters, right? When they can do that, then that gives elites, right, that gives, you know, people in political power the ability to be much more out of step with the messiness of public opinion, but never face consequences for it. You know, if instead of having to win 50% of your district plus one, you can actually just rewrite the district map so you're almost guaranteed 50% plus one, then you don't really need to worry about what the people you're representing actually think of what you're doing. You can simply change the people you're representing. It's a simple axiomatic way of thinking about politics. Voters are supposed to choose their politicians. Politicians are not supposed to choose their voters.
Well, that just makes sense. So if we were to look at ways we could begin a process of finding some common ground here, Ezra Klein, is it based on how we view our realities? As we started the conversation, it was like, listen, this isn't about issues. This is our belief about the world we're living in today. So how do we see a path to come to some terms there?
I am not a political consultant, and as I said, I'm not particularly optimistic. We're going to see a near-term way out of this division. You know, the thing that I do believe is that you win elections by, at least in part, governing well, right? I mean, I think Wisconsin is a good example of this. And so to the extent I have, you know, advice for anybody in politics, for the Biden administration, for anybody else, is that, you know, like if you have a strong record to run on, right, that's something. But as I was saying earlier, I don't think the path out of division right now is going to come through some kind of grand compromise. I think it's going to come because, you know, look, I am, to be blunt about it, not on the side of the sort of Make America Great faction in American politics. And the reason is I think it's like deeply out of step with a lot of our values, but also out of step with good governance. But that means that the people who do govern well have to do a really good job governing and then have to win elections. And then ultimately, if Republicans want to keep winning elections, which they've not had a great record on recently, they'll shift strategies and move more to the middle. Sometimes you don't win by compromise. Sometimes you win by winning. And then the other side figures out how to compromise. The Democrats had to do this in the sort of late 80s into the early 90s when Bill Clinton moderated the party. If Republicans, I think, keep losing, at some point they will probably do this again, too. But that requires Democrats to be exceptionally both strategic in their political positioning, but also effective in their governance, which is not, I think, something they always take as seriously as they need to, which is, in fact, the topic of my next book.
Looking forward to it. And looking forward to welcoming you to Wisconsin, Ezra Klein. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Ezra Klein writes for the New York Times opinion section, hosts the Ezra Klein Show podcast, and is author of Why We're So Polarized. On April 16th, Klein will be in Madison for a public talk about polarization with UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. While the event is currently sold out, more tickets may become available and released at a later date. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and before you throw away that old broken thing that's been lying around your house just taking up space, you may want to consider visiting a repair cafe. Repair cafes are free meeting places where folks are ready to help fix almost anything you need. You name it. Clothes, furniture, bikes, toys, appliances, electronics. Volunteers with skills of all kinds are on hand to help with just about everything. Martina Postma organized the first repair cafe in 2009 in Amsterdam. She then went on to found the Repair Cafe International Foundation to encourage and support repair cafes around the world, and she joins us now. Martina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here, and we invite you to the conversation, too, if you visited a repair cafe near you, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Martina, take us back to 2009 when you organized the first repair cafe in Amsterdam, where you are this afternoon. What need did you see that you wanted to fill here?
Well, I always thought that people didn't care about throwing away and about the waste they created, but at this first meeting, it became immediately clear that this is an issue for many people and that many people are, in fact, not happy with their own throwaway behavior, but that they didn't know what else to do. So it turned out to be a real possibility. When something like this is there, people were more than happy to use it, and people were very happy that there was an opportunity to have beloved broken items fixed so that they didn't have to throw them away. So that was an eye-opener for me too, because I wanted to help waste prevention. And at the same time, this turned out to be a very social thing too. It really got people talking about the subject of their throwaway behavior, about community, about sustainability. So it was a real conversation starter, and that was a real eye-opener for me too.
Yeah, and so we're talking about, 15 years ago now? And give us a little idea of how you've seen this repair cafe movement grow since your first one in Amsterdam in 2009, Martina.
Well, after this first, it was really a tryout. I just wanted to see if this kind of meeting would work, and it did. And then afterwards, people started to call me, and they said, couldn't we have coffee together sometime, and couldn't you give me some tips on how to organize this in my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. And there were so many people contacting me that I thought I need to scale this up a little bit. And then I started the foundation, and I wrote a starter kit so that to help people start their own repair cafe in their community, telling them what to do, how to go about it, where to find volunteers, how to select a venue, how to keep the volunteers happy, which tools to collect, how to create publicity. And this has become a comprehensive starter kit containing lots of other materials too, like posters that you can use to decorate the room, and a ready-made press release to send to the media. And so this helps people to get started in their own neighborhood. And first it was only available in Dutch, but we got a lot of media attention from the beginning. We had journalists from all over the world, really. So when they started publishing their reports and their radio and television shows, we got a lot of attention from the public in all those countries too. So we translated the materials into English, French, German, and Spanish. And now it's available in 5 languages all over the world, and people can order the starter kit from our website, repaircafe.org. And use it to start their own local initiative. And this way, we have grown from one repair cafe in 2009 to over 3,000 repair cafes in more than 40 countries across the world at this moment.
And now one in Wisconsin. We're talking about the Repair Cafe movement with its founder, Martina Postma. And now let's bring in Gary Hammond, who's on the committee of the Repair Cafe Oshkosh. Gary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey.
Also joining us, Michael Barucki is a volunteer with the Repair Cafe Oshkosh. And Michael, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Hey, Gary, let's start with you. How did this Repair Cafe Oshkosh get started?
Well, actually, Michael was the one that brought the idea to the Oshkosh area. He evidently was involved with it in the Ames, Iowa area. And he just basically put out a Facebook, at least from what I saw, a little ad saying, hey, we're looking at getting this Repair Cafe an opportunity to get started here in Oshkosh. And does anybody want to get involved? So I saw that and I thought that, that was a great idea of, you know, helping out your fellow neighbors and fixing some of their memorabilia and some of the stuff that they you know, have around the house that they don't necessarily have the skill set to fix. And if I or somebody else has an opportunity to help them out, why not? So I kind of give that hats off to Michael because he was one that really brought it to our attention because I knew nothing about it at the time.
Michael Barucki, walk us through an Oshkosh Repair Cafe. What items are people bringing to get fixed?
Yeah, so people are bringing clothing, computers, jewelry and watches, furniture. Gary actually fixes the furniture as well as other folks, but electronics, appliances, just household appliances. And in the previous repair cafes that we've had like bringing in small engines, actually. So those are... Yeah, those stay outside of the YMCA where we're at. But yeah, so you can bring in, you know, lawnmowers and whatnot for those kind of fixes. But just anything that you have, a household item that's broken can be brought in to be fixed.
Yeah, I kind of want to say everything but the kitchen sink, but I don't want to exclude the kitchen sink here. There might be somebody who can help with that too.
Actually, in fact, at the first repair cafe that we had, somebody brought in a mobile dishwasher.
See, there you have it. Everything and the kitchen sink, too. Michael, I understand you've had a few things repaired at the Repair Cafe in Oshkosh.
I did. Sort of looked around my house at the third Repair Cafe event that we hosted. Realized that, yeah, there were some things I just kind of put in the corner and could definitely bring them in. So I realized my coat was fraying, brought that in. I had a Tiffin lunchbox that was a, sort of a metal thing that was fixed, a headlamp, a reading light, and a laundry bag. Everything got fixed.
Martina Postma, founder of the Repair Cafe International Foundation. I've got news in about a minute, but I would be curious to hear from you whether or not what's happening in Oshkosh, Wisconsin sounds familiar to what's happening in over 3,000 locations around the world.
Actually, it does. That's so funny that the Repair Cafe is more or less the same wherever you go. It's really, the same atmosphere. People are very happy to be there and grateful for the help that they receive. And we see similar objects being brought in across the world, many electronics, small household appliances, small tools, clothing, bicycles. So yeah, it sounds very familiar.
Mobile dishwashers, you name it, everything and the kitchen sink. Martina Postma is the founder of the Repair Cafe International Foundation. Also joining us for the rest of this hour, Gary Hammond and Michael Barucki, who are volunteers with the Repair Cafe at Oshkosh. And we invite you to our conversation, especially if you've attended one of these repair cafes or would be interested in considering starting one in your area. What questions would you have about getting a repair cafe underway where you are? How do you organize all the fixers? How do you get all the equipment and gear? Martina Postma's got you started. Your questions, comments, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And from Amsterdam to Oshkosh, we're talking about the Repair Cafe movement with its founder, Martina Postma, who joins us from Amsterdam, where it's afternoon, along with Gary Hammond and Michael Barucki, who are volunteers with the Repair Cafe Oshkosh. And if you live in the Oshkosh area, the next Repair Cafe will be held on May 11th from noon to 4 at the Oshkosh Community YMCA downtown. If you have questions about the Repair Cafe movement, you can join us, or your experiences if you've been to one, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Gary Hammond, when it comes to the Repair Cafe in Oshkosh, where do you go to find the fixers that show up to repair everything, even perhaps a kitchen sink?
Well, I think that kind of comes down to the when you look at the community and the close-knit network that we have here. I got involved just simply saying, hey, I think this is a great idea. And when you start talking to people that you know that have similar skill sets, and I'm a retired tech ed teacher, so I reached out to other people that I knew that were resources in the community, and the people that said, hey, I think that's a great idea, they simply signed up and got involved, and as part of their expertise. So I think a sense of the community we have here is what are our opportunities to give back to, the people that are in our neighborhood? And it's been a great response. So We've been very fortunate that people, like to share their skill sets with other people.
Yeah. What are some of the items you've helped repair at the Repair Cafe Oshkosh, Gary?
Well, I've done generally, for the most part, either fixing furniture or bicycles. The first Repair Cafe we had, I started out in furniture and found out that the bicycle guys didn't show up. So I ran home and got my equipment, and I fixed bicycles for the day. And it's not this new stuff that's coming through the your local Trek bicycle or bicycle land or something like that. It's the stuff that people have had in their garage for maybe 10 years or 15 years, and it needs a derailleur cable or or some brake work or something. And it's a joy to see the kids to come in with their bicycles and say, hey, I've got a problem here, and you go through it, and you 10 minutes later, it's fixed, and then the kids, you see the lights shine in their eyes, saying, "Oh my gosh, my bicycle's been fixed."
Yeah,
and they're super happy about it, and it kind of varies. Like with the furniture side of it, we had a stool that came in the last repair clinic that probably from the 1920s, very fancy stools. I think it was from a player piano, they said.
Wow.
And one of the legs broke on it, so it was an antique, and it was like, okay, let's be very careful. So we do a good job of repairing this stool for them, and it comes down to using what the expertise you have and making sure that when that item goes out the door, that's functioning properly and it will work for them, hopefully for years to come.
Gary Hammond with Repair Cafe Oshkosh, also joining us from Repair Cafe Oshkosh, Michael Barucki. And Michael, what's it like when all these fixers come together? I feel like there's a lot of knowledge being passed back and forth.
That's absolutely a part of the magic of the Repair Cafe is, people want in the community, they want to help. They've got these skills and passing on these skills through knowledge share, through skill share, it happens spontaneously, and people have a lot of abilities, and I think the Repair Cafe is a place for people to come together, like Martine was mentioning earlier, that like you can come together and ask what do we need in this community? So three of the fixers actually at our Repair Cafe Oshkosh, they're starting a Repair Cafe in Appleton.
Oh.
And so it's Repair Cafe Fox Cities will be coming online shortly. So, they're still with us fixing, but they're also organizing in the next community. And and even my dad is organizing in the south suburbs of Chicago now, a Repair Cafe.
Well, and as Gary mentioned, this in Oshkosh, it started largely because you came from, you moved to Oshkosh, and it had a Repair Cafe in your previous community. How does Oshkosh's compare? And are there similarities? Are there differences you found, Michael Barucki?
Well, I think the main difference is the one in Ames, Iowa, is at the library, mm-hmm. and we are at the YMCA. But other than that, I think it's strangers in the community coming together, and it's just sort of a different space. It's a different yeah. experience that you can't really define, you know, unless you're there. You know, you can't really see it. So I would say anyone interested in starting a repair cafe should, like, come to a repair cafe for, you know, 15, 30 minutes to really kind of experience this. Because I think, as Martine also pointed out, that it's really the same in a lot of different spaces. It's, you know, people, it's foreign, I guess, in the beginning, but just go there for 15 minutes and then you will be really, you'll feel it, you'll get it.
It's a different reason to, I mean, it's not something you'd normally think of, the reason we'd all come together, and we're all coming together because we have something broken. We have people who can fix them, and that could create a very interesting sense of community. Martine Postma, who is a Repair Cafe Movement founder, joining us from Amsterdam this afternoon. Were you surprised by the community building that came out of fixing things?
Yeah, actually I was surprised, because for me it was means of reducing waste. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think of the social side in advance, but it turned out to be as important as the fixing side of it. And what Michael and Gary are telling here on the radio is really, well, it's really making me happy. And this makes my day, that a small idea is being picked up by people around the world. And what you're telling, like kids coming in with bicycles and having a sparkle in their eye after the repair, and people wanting to pass on their skills, it's part of the magic. That's really what it's about.
Yeah, but it didn't start that way. It wasn't about that at the beginning. It's almost as if the people that showed up made it that way.
Yeah, but that's the magic of Repair Cafe, yeah. I guess, because that happens everywhere all the time. There's always people, you come there as a visitor and you don't really expect your problem to be solved. And then when it turns out to be solved, you're really happy and you're grateful, and mm-hmm. there's applause and there's hooray. And so, yeah, that's what we see at repair cafes everywhere. And that's, well, I still find that wonderful.
Yeah. At the same time, I was surprised to find that there are some criticisms about repair cafes, that repair cafe organizers can find some criticism from makers of products being fixed. Is there a push back against repair cafes and folks who don't want you to fix it or want to say that it's just cheaper to buy a new one, Martina?
Yeah, that's what the manufacturers want us to believe, that we need new products every day. And so manufacturers are not happy with the repair cafe because they like to stress that repairing is very dangerous and that you should not do it, and you could leave it to the professional or not start it at all and just keep on buying new stuff. But more and more people understand that this is not sustainable, that we're polluting the earth and we're using way too much of the raw materials, and that we cannot go on doing that, and that repairing is a normal thing. Repairing gives you a good feeling, makes you feel strong, makes you feel proud. So once you've tried it, you will want to go on doing it. And I am confident that the manufacturers are not going to stop us, because the worldwide movement is growing stronger every day.
Gary, I have to ask you, what happens when you have a repair cafe and you finally come across something that somebody brings in that no fixer can fix?
Well, you know, I think that you know, it's happened. I've had, you know, some bicycles, some other things that have come in, and you know, you chat with the consumer. They're there to hopefully get their bicycle fixed or the piece of furniture to get fixed, and you're doing the best that you can to help them out. But sometimes it comes down to, yeah, you know, the cost of repairing this or whatever, it's simply cheaper and unfortunately to replace it with something new. But we always try to, you know, continue that process of fixing. And I've made referrals to, you know, take it to the bike shop downtown or take it to a local power center. And here's the issue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, for instance, with small engines, it might be the carburetors all plugged up. We can't fix that, so to speak, on the spot. We'll try, but they could take it to a local power center and say, hey, go over to Joe Schmoe's shop. You're going to need a new carburetor. He can order it and get it in and get it fixed and repaired for, let's say, $75 versus buying a new lawnmower for $500 or $600. So we try to continue to do that referral process because we're, you know, it comes down to we don't have a full shop down where we're doing the repair work. It's tooling that we need to do minor repairs and things that we can go through the process and help them with. But we may not have that specialty tool or the time to do that complete repair. So it's a, okay, well, take it over here and, you know, go through the process and have somebody else help you as well. So I think in that they get that second opinion from somebody that's independent versus taking it to a specific place that you know that's in business to repair or business to sell you something new. And I think it helps empower the public from that perspective, saying, hey, I've got somebody else that's on my side, so to speak, and can help me figure out what exactly is wrong, you know, with this product. So I think we get a lot out of it as volunteers because giving back to the community, you know, it's like Christmas. They say, you know, it's not the giver is getting as much out of that gift as the receiver.
Sure.
The same thing happens here. It's if we to see somebody happy and go away happy, or, you know, we teach them how to do a repair. Yeah. And they're ecstatic about it. Makes us feel really good as well.
Yeah, Michael Barucki, is there some training going on at the Repair Cafe in Oshkosh? How are people picking up what other fixers are doing there?
In terms of starting their own repair cafe?
Well, in terms of just figuring out how to fix something. Like, I would be curious to watch somebody fix up a bike and so I could possibly know it in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's big part of the process is the Skillshare. Mm. We don't have any formal classes per se, but there have been requests by in the community for folks to come in and help, you know, show how to repair something. So it's but we haven't really kind of formalized that yet, right? So it's an ad hoc process right now. If I might, could I share a couple of interesting anecdotes?
Michael, hold that thought if you would, and we will get right back to it. Our conversation continues with Martina Postma, a founder of the Repair Cafe International Foundation, who joins us from Amsterdam, and Gary Hammond and Michael Barucki, who are volunteers with the Repair Cafe at Oshkosh, and we invite you to our conversation before it concludes. 800-642-1234. Your questions about repair cafes, your comments about experiencing one. 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about repair cafes. And I look forward to hearing if the Repair Cafe movement in Wisconsin continues to grow beyond Oshkosh and apparently Appleton and outskirts of Chicago. Would you join in and attend a Repair Cafe in your area, either as a fixer or someone who just needs something fixed? 800-642-1234 to join us. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guests, Martina Postma, the founder of the Repair Cafe International Foundation, and Gary Hammond and Michael Barucki, who are volunteers with the Repair Cafe in Oshkosh. And Michael, you were about to tell us a little bit more about your experiences with these repair cafes, which, you know, go back to your time in Ames, Iowa.
Yeah, well, just to say that there was a couple, an elderly couple, that brought in Ames a toaster oven. And my friends, they worked on that repair for maybe 3 hours, maybe three of them.
Wow.
And turns out that toaster was their wedding present from 1955. So despite a little burnt toast smell in the in the room, it worked. Ultimately, it worked after that. So that was a really nice sentimental, you know, fix. And then the other one in Oshkosh, a fixer told me that a young couple had brought their little infant in. Of course, the infant wasn't to be fixed, but it was they got to talking. The infant's name was Oliver, and the fixer, his grandson is called Oliver, and ended up that he had clothes that he ended up, you know, giving to them outside of the repair cafe, but, you know, clothes in storage that he could give to this new family.
That's wonderful. So, I've got a question here from Wayne, who's in Partyville. He wants to ask, how can people support repair cafes? Do you take donations, Gary, or do you charge people?
No, but the clinics, when we do repair cafe, it's all free.
It's all free.
We talked about it when we initially organized of, you know, do we do something about charging or tips or whatever? And we kind of said, you know, something people always like to try and, you know, give you at least something. So we have a donation jar, so to speak, at our exit table that if people would like to donate and put something in there, we feel free to go ahead and do that. And so we have received a bunch of donations over this past year in that whole process. And the donations, we kind of say, well, what do we need for our next cafe? And it might be batteries for watches or just different items that we can use as part of that consumption process to offset some costs that we have. So, and again, it's worked out pretty well, but no, it's completely free.
And that next Repair Cafe Oshkosh will be held on May 11th from noon to 4 at the Oshkosh Community YMCA downtown. And as Gary says, it's completely free. And Martina, as the founder of this movement internationally, I'd ask you the same question that I asked Gary. How can people support repair cafes where they are?
They can donate, make a donation in the tip jar to their local repair cafe. Or if there is no repair cafe in their community yet, they can start one themselves. Of course, they can support the international movement by getting the starter kit and making a donation for the starter kit. And of course, by talking about it to friends and colleagues and family, spreading the concept and the idea and getting more people enthusiastic for repairing, because it's great fun.
And we all need a little something that probably could be fixed. And Martina, what advice would you offer for somebody who would be interested in starting a repair cafe for their community?
Well, first thing is, of course, to go to the website repaircafe.org/en. That's our English department. And then go to the start button and get the starter kit, because it will tell you everything you need to know about starting a repair cafe in your own community.
And Gary, what would your advice be for other Wisconsin communities that want to start a repair cafe?
Well, I think there's a need across the state for having repair cafes, you know, locally or regionally. And I think it really kind of comes down to, you know, talk to your friends, your neighbors, and see what's an opportunity that's out there, and you know, to start talking to people. That's all we really did, was we had some meetings at the local library and just started come up, let's start talking to some local businesses and finding a place to, you know, host it. And you know, just when you start reaching out and talking to different people in the area, somebody's always got a connection to somebody,
right,
that can help you out. And that's kind of what we did, and it just kind of worked out real well. And it wasn't necessarily a stressful process, other than having the first cafe and hoping that people show up, which they did, which was a good thing. And it's, you know, it's grown, and that's what we wanted to have happen, was have it start off and grow a little bit each time. And so we got a good foot, so to speak, out there, and the community knows that we're around.
And Michael Barucki, these repair cafes seem to follow you wherever you go, and seem to tail off from you and follow family members and friends. Where would you like to see this movement go, especially here in Wisconsin?
Well, in every community, it could easily happen. I'm really interested in how other projects can sort of be born from a repair cafe. So you're having getting people together in the community about like needs and desires. And so in Ames, for instance, the repair cafe there sprouted a seed library. So there they have a seed library within the library now. It's connected to the repair cafe. It's sort of it's not the same people, but it's very, very connected in a way. Now, for us as well in Oshkosh, Gary and I are both involved in a tool library, sort of beginning stages of what a tool library could look like. With other fixers. Yeah.
I think I would like to participate. I could use a tool library myself. That sounds great, as opposed to having to buy every tool for every fix-it occasion. Martinez, you started this movement back in 2009 in Amsterdam. What's it sound like to hear, or what's it feel like to hear the stories of how this has taken off in Oshkosh, Wisconsin?
Well, as I said, it really makes me happy to hear what Michael and Gary are telling, because that's really what I wanted, the enthusiasm to bring people together, to give them an opportunity to have items fixed and to see that there are other solutions than going to the store and buying new stuff every day. And that you're also offering solutions for other problems, like the seed library. That's a really great initiative. And so I'm really grateful to hear that so many people like this concept and are so motivated to bring this further.
Martina, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
And Gary and Michael, thank you both to you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Martina Postma is the founder of the Repair Cafe International Foundation. Gary Hammond and Michael Barucki are volunteers with the Repair Cafe in Oshkosh. And if you live in the Oshkosh area, the next Repair Cafe will be held on May 11th from noon to 4 at the downtown Oshkosh Community YMCA. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.